Hello and welcome to the Guardian Film Show, preaching the gospel and forecasting storms. Coming up this week, we've got a biblical epic, a dystopian teen fantasy, two Jesse Eisenbergs for the price of one, and a documentary that crams no fewer than 53 films into a single enticing package. So many films, how will we manage? We're going to need a bigger boat. The heavens open and the movies pour forth. Jesse Eisenberg encounters double trouble in The Double. Shailene Woodley fights the power that is Kate Winslet in Divergent. And Mark Cousins brings the camera down to ankle-biting level for a story of children and film. But in the beginning, there was Noah, Darren Aronofsky's bullish take on the Old Testament story about a God-fearing man who built himself a floating zoo. The Guardian's Andrew Pulver sailed into town to meet the man himself, otherwise known as Russell Crowe.
Mythology. You can find this in a lot of different places. You know, our geology will talk of a flood mythology. Archaeology will talk of a flood mythology. The Australian Aboriginals have a flood mythology. So, to me, it was, I just got to find the human in this. You know, I get rid of the resonance, get rid of the allegory, all of these things that the movie may add up to. I just got to find this bloke. If I've come across as passionate in the defense of the film, it's probably because of the volume of criticism. You know, criticism that by and large is based on people's opinion without seeing the actual work. I was expecting a certain amount of criticism, but I just wasn't probably expecting a certain level of aggression in the criticism, you know. It's my opinion that, my personal opinion that the Bible or the Quran or the Torah or whatever ancient religious text you want to talk about leaves quite a large space for individual interpretation. So to kind of, you know, make a statement where only your imagination is the true imagination, it seems to me to be, you know, a little extreme.
The critics come in two by two. Here's Peter Bradshaw and Andrew Pulver.
Breeding pairs, yes.
Hopefully your mate later.
Yeah, exactly.
Peter, did this Noah lift you to higher ground?
Reasonably higher ground. I thought it was an interesting movie. I thought it's a very bold choice. Interesting. Kind of an event, in a way, to choose this kind of Old Testament story. I thought, considering how big and macho Russell Crowe is, and really no other actor is possible for the role, and if, as long as Russell Crowe is in show business, then Old Testament movies will be possible. I thought it was weirdly kind of uncertain in a way. I thought underneath all the bluster and the bravado and the massive kind of action adventure furniture, weirdly I felt that Aronofsky wasn't quite sure how far to take it in any direction, really. And it's very unusual compared to all his other movies, have had a sense of absolute ringing certainty, or whether that's The Wrestler, which in a way is comparable to this, or Requiem for a Dream, or Pi, again, because Pi, the sense of abstract deities, again, comparable, or even awful films like The Fountain, a kind of terrible film. He all knew what he was doing. Whereas here I sense that he'd been sort of chopped about,
obeying the word of God, yes. But God in this case is the Hollywood studio,
exactly.
Isn't it? So he's fighting against
that. I felt
that
he didn't know, you know, does he revamp Noah for a new audience, a modern audience, a secular, even an unbelieving audience? And I felt also that his technique was, again, slightly compromised. I felt that he didn't quite know how far to go against the grain of traditional storytelling. We had that already very much talked about sequence, the what I think of as the Tree of Life sequence, where in his strobo time-lapse technique, he recapitulates the creation and the fall, which has had swooning reviews. I didn't think it was all that exciting compared to what he's done in that technique in his
and
earlier films.
And it's equivocating as well, isn't it? It's not really taking a stance one way or the other.
Yeah, yeah. And also, once it's gone, and it's only 5 minutes, then we're back to a pretty conservative way of telling the story.
Andrew, at the risk of picking holes in the Bible, isn't there a slight sort of dramatic problem here in that he's supposedly this lone man, and yet he's got a powerful army, he's got God on his side and these big stone giants. So you think, well, of course he's going to win.
On some level. I mean, I think his basic conceit of over Noah and his motivations are essentially, it may seem a bit strange, but Noah is basically a junkie, and that he has these visions which are his sort of dialogue with God. Because, Aronofsky is not going to portray the actual conversations with God on screen, and his metaphor, his conceit is to have him sort of drink funny tea or just sort of have sort of strange repeated visions, and that's what actually for me links it very much to Requiem for a Dream, because he uses the same sort of junky technique that he had in that film, which I think he calls hip hop editing or something like that. And I suppose the sort of disconnect that you feel in it is that Russell Crowe, fantastic though he is in the role, doesn't really seem like much of a visionary junkie type guy. He's very much a man of action, you know, kind of slicing the armies and building the boat. And I suppose one question would be, what would the film been like if there was somebody a bit more sort of strung out in the lead role?
Andrew's raised a very interesting point. It would be very interesting to have another version of Noah where you think that possibly Noah is crazy. Mm. He's having kind of peyote dreams, and he's bullied and abused his family into building some strange craft, and he's managed to get a few animals in there, and there is some sort of a flood, and he sort of dies at the end. To have a kind of secular, unbelief version of Noah.
Yeah, with Willem Dafoe.
Yeah, exactly. That would be fascinating. It wouldn't necessarily be less valid than this, but it would be fascinating. What I found, it's inevitable. You can't put God on screen. It just looks ridiculous. But I think one of the things about the Old Testament is God appears as a character. That's one of the fascinating things, almost the modern avant-garde quality of the Old Testament, is that God isn't just a concept. He appears as a character on equal terms and talks to, as it were, Adam or Noah, and has dialogue scenes with him. And in the end, in the Bible, he comes back and talks to Noah about what he's decided to do as a result of all this. And he has the covenant with God. And the covenant is here, spoiler alert, slightly abolished. All the stuff about eating meat or draining blood, all the stuff about dietary precautions, that's been abolished in a way and reabsorbed into interesting, but I think slightly less eco stuff about vegetarianism, which I didn't quite buy.
You seem to be saying that Aronofsky isn't necessarily the best man then to tackle this particular story.
Well, no, I think he could be. If he was given his head, he would be a brilliant man to tackle this story. It's so difficult to do as a big studio picture on a subject which inevitably the studio and the producers are going to be subject to so much pressure and so much commercial pressure. I think he did just about as well as he could do. It's not a masterpiece. I would be fascinated to see how he would do it as a young man, sort of 10 or 20 years ago, if he could somehow do it as with an independent producer and do it at, somehow manage to do it at a fraction of the cost, which CGI apparently is reputedly making available, you know, to do it somehow as some kind of lo-fi version and to really let rip with some real Timothy Leary stuff and make sure the Timothy Leary stuff doesn't just stop after 5 minutes and we go back to, as it were, King of Kings after a while. To really let rip with some freaky deaky stuff, that would be great.
I mean, I think after all, once it's all over, you have to kind of remember what it isn't, and it isn't a sort of dull, ultra-safe, sort of aimed at the evangelicals film. And since there's quite a lot of that around at the moment and Hollywood studios are very paranoid about alienating the big religious audience in the States, it's a brave film, and I think you have to hold up your hand and say that, for Aronofsky, that he did push the boat out, perhaps not.
Literally.
Quite puzzling. Yeah.
He did.
This all belongs to me. This land, this forest, that stronghold of yours. Did you really think you could protect yourself from me in that?
It's not protection from you.
Then what is it?
An ark. To hold the innocent when the Creator sends his deluge to wipe out the wicked from this world.
Return to your cities of Cain! No, we have all been judged.
I have men at my back, and you stand alone and defy me. I'm not alone.
So many wild actors there, but only one of them gets to play the role of Ham. Next up, we have Divergent, the tale of a fetching nonconformist teen in a totalitarian future America. The great Catherine Shord sat down with the film's co-star, Kate Winslet.
The future belongs to those who know where they belong.
You're nervous, aren't you?
Why would I be nervous? We're just gonna decide the rest of our lives.
You're different. If you don't fit into a category, they can't control you. They call it Divergent.
When you have a particular religion that you follow or a spiritual belief, you know, your determination to absolutely remain faithful and truthful to that thing that you believe in, you know, there's a heck of a lot to be said for that level of conviction, you know. It's really quite wonderful in a way. As far as Janine is concerned, you know, she's absolutely doing what she believes in, you know. She's absolutely seeing it through.
Good on it. Sort of, I suppose so.
The system removes the threat of anyone exercising their independent will. Divergents threaten that system. It won't be safe until they're removed.
Do you think that we're getting cinema nowadays that sort of presupposes that there will be some sort of major apocalypse and now looks to the future? And do you think that that will happen?
I don't know what I think. I really don't know what I think. But I think we are seeing more films like this. And what's so fun about them is that we, of course, we don't know what's going to happen. And so actually films of this nature can be about so many different things. And so the scope is so vast, which makes it much more fun, I think, for audiences, and it certainly makes it a heck of a lot of fun for actors, believe me.
Peter, this is based on a young adult trilogy. Were you familiar with it before seeing this film?
I feel I am very familiar with it. I don't know if you remember all those spoof genre movies we used to get, like Not Another Teen Movie and Vampires Suck. This is like that, basically. This is like a very straight spoof movie called, like, Not Another YA Genre Movie About a Teen Girl Who Is Lonely and Yet She Has Something Special. She Is the One movie, or something like that. You're right, it is exactly like Hunger Games, exactly like Ender's Game, exactly like Hogwarts, really. It's so generically specific. I feel like I've read it already and seen it 1,000 times. I have done, in fact.
And yet it's all about nonconformity.
It's all about nonconformity, and that's the terrible irony. Of course, it is pitched with laser-like accuracy and efficiency at teenage girl readers who are lonely and unhappy and think that they are special. Of course, aren't we all, darling? And I found that it was sort of reasonably well done, but a lot of it is so indulgent. It's just so predictable. It's outrageous. Having said that, I quite like Shailene Woodley. She was in The Descendants. She played the teenage girl in The Descendants. And she's not bad in some ways. I think she looks the part more than Jennifer Lawrence in some ways. But
but she's no Jennifer Lawrence. She doesn't have the kind of fierceness and intensity.
She doesn't have that Amazonian quality.
No.
But she can credibly be ordinary. She doesn't look pretty in the way that Jennifer does, in my J-Law does. What was she? Shea Wood.
Shea Wu.
And I thought there was something disturbingly reactionary about this movie, because there are five factions, you're sure. One of which is Dauntless, and they are the kind of tough guys. Mm-hmm. One of which is Abnegation. They're like the Amish ones, and there's a couple of those, Candor and Amity. And the other one is Erudite. Mm. And they're the intelligentsia. They run the law courts and everything like this. And you think, golly, I wonder which one is going to be turn out to be the bad guy. Now, the rule in this case is look for the Brit character actor.
Yeah.
And there's Kate Winslet. And guess what? It's Erudite. Mm. And there's something rather reactionary. They say that, you know, Dauntless, they're good, and Abnegation, they're good as well. But these brainiacs, they really can't be trusted. They cannot be trusted. And there's something creepy and almost sort of Philistine as part of the irrationale.
Are you speaking, though, as a card-carrying member of the Brainiac fraternity?
You may very well say that, and I couldn't possibly comment. But I feel that what the YA bestseller movement has said to us is, look, the great thing about Harry Potter and all these things is that it's getting kids reading. It's getting kids interested in brainy and intellectual pursuits. And here we have this book saying, actually, braininess isn't great. You know, not only is it not as important as being courageous and moral, which of course, is an entirely reputable position, but there's something suspicious about it. And I think there's something kind of weirdly Philistine about this movie.
Points for bravery, Stiff.
You all right?
You cut me.
I meant to.
Shailene Woodley is Divergent. High time for a documentary, so we shall now settle back, dim the lights, and let Mark Cousins tell us a story of children and film.
In his Edinburgh flat, the critic and filmmaker Mark Cousins sets up a camera to record his niece and nephew at play. This, it transpires, is our gateway to a cinematic Shangri-La of films about children, stretching back nearly a century and embracing classic blockbusters and obscure art house treasures alike.
Andrew, we're showing a still from Kez there, but there were many, many films in this documentary that rather shamefully, I didn't even know existed.
Absolutely. I mean, for me, that is actually this film's sort of greatest achievement, really, is to disinter tons of Iranian and Latvian and French films that all feature kids doing sort of odd and interesting things that have all been completely disappeared. There's a fantastic shot. I remember he gets out of a Czech film, I think it is, where which is just some kid lying down on his hand.
Oh yeah, reaching up to his mum.
You know, just coming out of frame below. Mm. Just shot absolutely beautifully, and yet it's a film that's been kind of completely abolished. As a whole, I mean, Mark Cousins, people may or may not be aware of, he's a sort of writer and critic, does all sorts of sort of odd and interesting things, and this has become one of his sort of specialities. He made a sort of very interesting documentary about taking a sort of cinema to Afghanistan, I think it was, or Northern Iraq, I can't quite remember, and showing children films who they'd never seen one before. And then this, I think, flowed out of that, grew out of that. And it is, in some ways, it's a kind of quite a basic, old-fashioned essay film, which you don't really get too much of these days. He does lots of close analysis of shots, which is very interesting because you don't often get.
Yeah, he's great on the whole composition of movie image.
Although I'm not 100% convinced about his conclusions about what the compositions actually represent that he's talking about, etc., etc. And he talks very convincingly about the different types of childhood emotion that are portrayed. Again, doesn't necessarily always add up for me, but it's very interesting seeing some of the stuff he's dug up.
Andrew describes it as an essay. I mean, it's discursive and loquacious. Did the kind of lack of a kind of rigorous point or argument worry you?
No, not at all. In fact, I think it was specifically that which allows Mark to kind of get away with stuff. If he was trying to make a rigorous point, then he would be exposing himself to disagreement on so many fronts that his film would turn out to be a much more fragile and vulnerable and questionable project than in fact it is, because it's so personal, and you can only respond to it as a personal kind of flight of fancy through the world of cinema, that it works, and as well as it does.
And it's about a kind of inarticulate magic, isn't it, of child performance?
I thought it was. I think it's a brilliant film. I think it's entirely distinctive, entirely personal. So many films resemble each other. Here's something which absolutely does not resemble everything else. As a critic, I've come to love Mark in a way for offering his readers a tone which is entirely different from the sort of sarky, knowing kind of nasal tone that we all have in a way. He is unashamedly celebratory and positive. And I think this film is a kind of cinephile gem. In a way, it returns us to the old way of thinking about criticism of the sort of early 60s of Truffaut and Godard, the idea of criticism being close, much closer than we thought, to the act of making cinema itself. Mm. He brings his cinephile passion and enthusiasm, he unites the act of criticism and the act of filmmaking in a very interesting way, and a way which, I'd say, hasn't been seen for sort of 40 or 50 years, really. That idea of cinephilia and criticism as a radically engaged activity, I think, is absolutely great.
A Story of Children and Film there. And happily, many of the films that are featured there can be seen in their entirety in a travelling film house season. Screening details can be found at the website cinemaofchildhood.com, and they're well worth checking out. Just time for one more film before the rains come down. This is The Double, and here is director Richard Ayoade and Mia Wasikowska.
How long have you been here, son? Just started, eh?
Yes, sir, 7 years ago.
I hope you can raise the level of your performance.
I'd like to introduce everyone to our newest co-worker, James Simon.
Paris, the new employee. Did he remind you of anyone?
Who did you have in mind?
Me, for instance.
To me, the thing that was always just funniest was that the doppelganger appears, you know, the main character sees this person who looks exactly like him, and then he points it out to someone else, and then that person isn't bothered. And to me, it was just, I never in a million years could have thought of that as a way to take it. But it's so funny that it's so against the expectation that your concerns would immediately concern other people.
What'll it be?
What do you want to... Okay, no, sorry, then. I'll just have a Coke and a bagel.
We're out of bagels.
Oh, right, then... right, then I'll just...
Come on.
Right, sorry, I just... I'll just have the Coke then, I guess.
A Coke. And you?
A coffee.
A coffee.
And scrambled eggs.
You don't serve breakfast in the evening?
Why not?
Because it says so on the menu.
Well, do you still have eggs here?
Yeah.
And do you have a frying pan?
Yeah.
Then do me a favor and make me some scrambled eggs.
It's kind of this paranoid, like, breakdown, and it is ambiguous as to, you know, how, you know, if, whether it's one person or two people, or, you know, whether someone's just going mad, or is it, you know, super, not science fiction, whatever that word is, supernatural. Hard to find. Don't you mind
people grinning? In your feet. When you read a really great book, like, I don't know, say you read Catcher in the Rye or Crime and Punishment, you don't feel... You feel you're just guessing everything. You don't feel like I've brought some great wealth to this. You just feel, how does this writer manage to understand everything? And that's what I felt, you know, reading the book, like, how has he managed to tap into this sort of anxiety or fear or humour that you don't even realise is there until you read it in some ways, but you recognise it once you do.
Peter, it's the story of a double and a copy, but it's also a copy of a lot of other directors as well, often very knowingly.
Yes, I kind of had mixed feelings about this when I sat down to it, because the idea of a double, especially shot in this kind of grainy, gloomy way, it could have been terrible. I mean, a friend of mine was telling me that in film schools, the double is used all the time in kind of graduation,
low budget
graduation pieces. There is a million trillion graduation film school pieces where a bloke gets up in the middle of the night to find himself looking at the fridge in the kitchen. I mean, there are so many of them apparently, and I really thought, oh my God, I hope this isn't like this, and it isn't. It is very cinephile. It's very film buff. But it's also got a sense of humour, because Richard Ayoade has some real training in proper professional show business comedy, and he does some very funny things in it. And I thought it was great. I really, as I say, I had worries about it. I thought this is going to be very arch and terrible, and it could have been very humourless. In the hands of almost anyone else, it could have been horribly humourless and terrible. But actually, it's kind of great. Mm. It's very well designed. At least it's very thoroughly designed. It has references to David Lynch and Billy Wilder, and what I presume is a reference to Aki Kaurismäki.
Yeah, Andrew, what did you think of it?
I suppose, like Peter, I went into it with sort of mixed feelings. I don't think I came out of it quite so buoyed as Peter was in that. I mean, Richard Ayoade always reminds me of a sort of British answer to Wes Anderson. It's always terribly controlled. I mean, certainly with Submarine and now with this, terribly controlled design the slightly effectless acting, I found it quite difficult to get into because of the deliberate disengagement from any sort of like obvious context. I think the original story is very much, this is 19th century Russia, and it's pointing out how absurd it is. This obviously strayed into more, obviously, kind of Kafkaesque territory, you know, like a trial, which is obviously in some sort of mad place that doesn't exist. And this was like a Gilliam-ified version of the trial in some ways. But I think, you know, Jesse Eisenberg, again, held it together because he's a very watchable guy, very funny, very needling sort
of
character.
He's perfect for this kind of role.
And he sort of really pulled it off, I think.
It also reminded me, in a way, because of Jesse Eisenberg, of Dylan Kidd's Roger Dodger, all the sort of sexual coaching stuff, which there is an interesting kind of genealogy, because Dylan Kidd, who hasn't had much to do, but what he did do is he made an American TV movie version of Peep Show, working with Armstrong and Sam Bain. And so there is this interesting connection with the world of British comedy.
It's a sort of weird cross-pollination going on.
Interesting cross-pollination, exactly. And I wonder if Richard Ayoade at some level was remembering Roger Dodger, because it was such a brilliant film and such a brilliant debut for Eisenberg.
Jesse Eisenberg facing his own worst nightmare in The Double. And that's it from us. My thanks to my own nightmare doppelgangers, Peter Bradshaw and Andrew Pulver. Thanks to you for watching. We're back next week.